Call Weekend Breakfast now on
011-883-0702.
Good morning, Paul. Always great catching up with you, man.
Oh, super. Good to chat to you again.
Great stuff, mate. Trust. I said it in the beginning, the key question when one hears about a trust or any such mechanism, you know, such legal mechanism, all too often it's easy to fall into the trap and say, I don't have enough money for that. That's for the rich. That's something that I don't have to bother with, you know. What is a trust? How does it operate? And, you know, how can it be beneficial? And who really should be catching in on it? I guess let's start with what is a trust?
Well, a trust is its own entity. We must make it very clear that when you set up a trust and you put assets into that trust, you relinquish the ownership of the property as well. So let's take any form of assets. You can put your house in, you can put your shares in, you can put investments in, any form of property. So a trust then takes over the ownership, and you no longer have ownership of that particular property. And what that then does is it becomes its own entity in the sense that it's controlled by a board of trustees, which are elected in terms of setting up the trust. And therefore, the trustees now determine what and how those particular assets are dispersed or used or invested for that matter. So it's very, very useful in the one sense that you have this very useful entity, which when you die one day, this particular trust will carry on moving in a direction that's determined by the trustees and a trust deed for that matter. You don't then fall into the trappings of tax at death. And also things like the perpetuity of that trust will carry on. So no death duties are triggered in the event of you dying. So it becomes a very useful entity in certain instances. But as I said up front, or as you mentioned as well, alluded to, it's not for everyone. It's probably got to be really in place for specific reasons. And if you don't fit into those reasons, then you might be wasting a lot of time and money as well.
So let's look at a couple of those reasons before we start sort of breaking down, you know, the finances behind it or the money behind it. I guess that's the next question. But what are some of the reasons that one would set up a trust?
Well, certainly you'd want to look at it if you want to keep your assets, growth assets in particular. If you want to keep them for future generations, this becomes a very useful entity. Let's take farming, for example. You know, farmers spend a lot of time, effort, and money setting up farms, and they become generational types of financial objectives. So when you die one day and you have a farm in a trust, you can rest assured that that farm will not be affected by your death, and you can then have the growth of the farm and all its whatever you've set up on it inside a trust, and it becomes a benefit for future generations. And, when children pass on and their children then take over, they can carry on inheriting or using this farm without any consequential financial costs such as death duties and things. And that growth asset is always protected inside that trust. And it's probably going to be that kind of thing that you would want. If you've got large, sizable growth assets, which will attract lots of capital gains tax at death, a lot of debt duty should you pass on, you probably would want to start considering a trust for those reasons in particular. Also, as well, a trust does also have a protection on the assets. Mm-hmm. You could have a business, for example, in a trust. And if you, for example, fall into some kind of insolvency where creditors are after you as an individual, you've got the peace of mind that they can come and fetch whatever you have in your personal capacity, but they can't touch whatever's in the trust. The trust doesn't, the assets don't belong to you. Therefore, it does give you that asset protection as well.
Which is very, very, very important there as well. And I think something to think about. Minor children, and I guess that's one of the key things. It's unfortunately a stark question that you are faced with. My eldest is seven. You obviously start having the discussion about setting up a will. et cetera, et cetera. And you know, you want to obviously leave a legacy for your children. But as we know, as certain as taxes and death are, unfortunately, death is not timed. You know, you don't know when it's going to happen. Mm. And obviously, I know for a fact that I can't leave over all our assets, assuming that, you know, our estate has assets left over, to Michael, and say to Michael, listen, you decide how you spend the money after this. I mean, he's seven, for goodness sake. So how does this trust help under those circumstances?
Well, you raise a very, very important question here, because Michael cannot make any financial decisions. He doesn't have the capacity to contract. He's a minor. Hmm. And the last thing you want to do is leave assets to a minor. Because what actually happens technically, if there is no will in place and, you know, there's no guardian elected or whatever, those assets would be probably sent off to the guardian fund, which is a fund set up independently, which you don't have any control on. And Michael will have to wait until 18 before he gets the benefits of those, of that. Look, you can, a guardian can go to the fund along the way and make representation for things that he might need leading up to 18. But the point is that you don't have control. So to your question, you certainly would want to consider in your will to set up what we call a testamentary trust.
Mm.
And what that is, it's not a trust that you put into existence straight away. What you do is you leave it alone inside your will, and it only then gets set up once you die. And you set up yourself with that particular, you set up a testamentary trust with a guardian that you nominate, someone that you really can trust to look after Michael for his interests. And that particular entity will then also have an age that you elect sometime in the future. Mm. And you may want to consider something longer than 18, because at 18 even, you know, what do children know about, you know, finances? And if it's a sizable trust, you may want to consider him being a little bit more mature and maybe setting it up for 20 or 25 even, before he gets the residue or what's left over in the trust. But you've got the peace of mind that along the way with the guardian, that testamentary trust will have provisions for him through schooling and all those lifestyle needs that he might come across.
The one thing that you made mention of is control. And I mean, that's something I guess all of us want to some extent. Obviously, in the instance of a testamentary trust, you don't have physical real-time control, considering that you have passed on. But when it comes down to control, I guess the key question is, when I'm handing it over to a group of elected trustees that make these particular decisions, am I able to influence them at all? Am I able to control the process at all? Are they bound to listen to me? And I guess part of the reason for that also is that, yes, I wanted to, to say, for example, protect my children, provide for them after my passing in the example of a testamentary trust. But also, you know, I wouldn't want someone to, act willy-nilly with my assets and sort of just my assets just disappear and no one's taken to any account.
Well, you do have a very good point there, because the control element is very specific in a trust. You cannot set up a trust and take full control of it. I mean, you defeat the objective of the trust. So when it comes to a testamentary trust, generally what you do is the trustees are appointed, but in a very professional capacity. You probably would want to consider a professional trust set up with professional trustees. And when you do that in your will, you know, you do it with normal sort of banking institutions and financial institutions. They do this sort of thing.
Mm.
They have professional trustees in place. And the mandate there in a testamentary trust would be purely the interest of the beneficiary of the trust, which would be Michael in this particular case. And they would be very cognizant of the way to manage those assets, and they will do it purely in the interest of the child.
Mm.
When it comes to an inter vivos trust, which is a trust that you're now working with in your own capacity, you've got to be very careful there too. The number of trustees is important, because you can't just be the one sole trustee of your trust, because you've defeated the control mechanism there as well. Mm. What you need at least three or more trustees. And when that trust is set up, it's set up in a very specific way with a document called the trust deed. And that particular deed outlines exactly who will benefit, how the assets will be dispersed, the discretionary powers of the trustees to look after the beneficiaries in terms of the assets. So when you pass or when you are even on that board of trustees, you don't have any say around it. The management of the trust is actually according to the trust deed. And that's a very important document and a way to make sure that the controls are left for the trustees alone in terms of that particular mandate that they get from the deed.
I mean, that for me is quite fundamental and you know, interesting, because the thing is, I guess when you leave this, you know, when you put this money into a trust, and I guess it boils down to the issue of trust, you know, excuse the pun, is that you hope that, you know, and you trust that this money is going to be to the benefit of other people. And I guess the one big concern always is you know, money tends to be one of those really difficult topics. Is this person going to do things for the benefit of those that I've left it for, et cetera, et cetera? So it does become a bit of a sticky point there. Now, in terms of, you know, for people who are considering this, there's all kinds of things that you have to worry about. How much tax do I pay? When is it taxed comparatively to other regimes that exist, et cetera, et cetera? In terms of tax and the implications and the impact of tax, how does it work? And when does it work? When doesn't it work? Who is it for ultimately?
Well, again, here you've got to be very careful. A trust is one of the highest tax entities. Over companies and individual tax, a trust actually pays the most tax.
Wow.
It pays a tax at a rate of 45%. Now, if you've got some assets, for example, you might have some assets in cash, you're earning interest on that and in your individual capacity. And we know that the interest exemption on tax is 28,500 rand, I think it is, for an exemption on that interest. So anything above that in interest, you'll pay tax on. But you get quite a sizable chunk of exemption on interest or taxable interest in your own hands. In a trust, you're going to pay a flat 45% on the first rand that you earn on interest. So be very careful about what you put into your trust, because you're going to lose things like exemptions. And you're also, in the event of a, let's take your house, for example, you may want to put your primary residence into a trust.
Mm.
And when you sell it in the future, in an individual capacity, you can get up to 2 million rand off the capital gains that's due on the sale. But a trust doesn't get that. So it could be very expensive for you if you have a residence in a trust and decide to sell it a little later on. Because the capital gains will be that more sizable. And remember, at a rate of 45%, which is probably going to hurt you in comparison to having had that property in your own hands.
I mean, that is a bit of a clap, to put it quite frankly.
Sure, most certainly. So many people have actually been caught short in that, because, you know, trusts many years ago was the kind of thing to do. And it was quite a cool thing to have, you know, when you talked around a braai or a dinner party or whatever, and you spoke about your trust, you know, it was the thing. But along came quite a lot of conditions, and especially when capital gains came into effect in 2001. People realized then, wow, I should have had this, you know, my primary residence should have been in my own name and not in that trust, because they got hurt a little later on.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I guess it also boils down to the whole issue of asset protection and what people are weighing up for and what do you have it for ultimately. But I mean, I guess one of the key things that then immediately stands out is that the future is pretty undetermined. And if you're going to have this idea that this house or this property is going to remain in this trust forever and ever, I will never run into the 45% tax rate issue one day when I need to sell it or do whatever the case is, or whatever the tax rate would be, the applicable tax rate would be at the time. The fact of the matter is, you don't know what happens, I don't know, next month when you get that call and you get to move to, I don't know, the UK on a job opportunity or something.
Well, there again, the practicalities of the trust needs to be really well examined before you enter into it. And one of the things is, if your estate is under 3.5 million rand, in fact, it actually works this way. If you're married and you die, you can leave everything to your spouse and not pay a cent in estate duty in the first instance. It's only on the death of your spouse that the duty is payable. And every individual, when they die, gets 3.5 million rand off their estate before they pay estate duty. And if you don't use it, you roll it over to your surviving spouse. So technically speaking, you can have, if your trust is, sorry, not your trust, but if your estate is under 7 million rand, you're going to avert paying any form of estate duties in that particular case. So a trust doesn't really have a place or space there. In terms of costs. And remember, too, that there's a lot of administrative burdens in a trust as well. I mean, you have to prepare financials every year and obviously pay tax, for tax returns and things, and the administrative burden there doesn't come free. So why have the hassle of a trust if your estate is under 7 million rand? And if you organize it carefully within a will, a good, sound, solid will, you probably find that that's just as easy and far more efficient than keeping a trust for the wrong reason.
Let's quickly go to Pam in Four Ways. That is a quick question for you, Paul, if you don't mind. Pam, good morning.
Sure. Hi, Paul. A friend of mine is getting divorced, and they've sold their property, which is in a trust. It was in both their names and the father. The father since passed away, so it's in both their names. And now, when that payout comes from the house, are they going to have to pay that 45% tax? And also, her husband hasn't worked in 15 years. He's an alcoholic. And now it means he's going to get half of the money. Is there any way that she can see a lawyer and possibly give him so much money a month to live on? Or I don't know what your thoughts are.
Thanks, Pam.
And just to clarify, are the assets in a trust at the moment?
Beg your pardon?
Is the house in the trust and the source of income from the trust? Well, you see, the trust deed will determine who's going to get what. To your question around the capital gains or the cost of the sale of the house, that's going to be borne inside the trust at a rate of 45%. Well, it's not really 45%. It's 45% of the growth that will be taxed, or subject to capital gains tax. And the trust will actually have the burden of paying, or the liability of paying that tax inside itself. However, there is a way, and I think you've got to take some good financial advice around this with your lawyer and or an accountant, where you can pass the tax liability across to the beneficiaries. It's called the conduit principle. So if it is too burdensome inside the trust and it has a leeway of getting a softer tax approach, you can actually pass the liability to each other as beneficiaries. And as far as the income is concerned, the same thing applies. Whatever is taxed inside the trust, it's only taxed there. And so your father-in-law, I think you said, who needs the income, the trustees can elect to give him a source of income, but it'll be taxed in the hands of the trust, but to him it'll be tax-free because it's after tax. But these are quite careful considerations, and there are avenues that you've got to explore inside the trust through the trustees that are in place there to see which is more beneficial in every instance. But the point I'm making is that the trust has to deal with the cost and the tax. And then you'd have to make, as a trustee, you'd have to make the appropriate distribution of those assets to whoever is on that trust deed.
Paul, you know, I two more questions, but we're short on time. But I think that the most important question ultimately is that when it comes to the consideration of setting up a trust in the first place, who do you go and see? I think that all too often would be, you know, the starting point and the difficulty for a lot of people is that this is probably, you know, the first time that someone hears about this thing, this mechanism called a trust. They don't quite understand it, or maybe they've heard about it, but people just don't quite understand how it all works. Where do you go to get good, sound advice where someone is not just saying, okay, I'm going to make a buck out of this and, you know, I'm sorted?
Well, that's a good question as well, because a trust, it's very easy to set up a trust. There's a registration process and you've got to get the entity in place. But you have to be very careful that SARS sees it as an authentic trust. It's not just one of these trusts that you put on the shelf and you think you've got it, but SARS doesn't agree that it actually is an authentic one. So you need to deal with professionals that set up trusts, and there are many of them, probably also through a sound financial advisor who could actually put you in place with or put you in touch with one. But most of the financial institutions do have businesses in setting up trusts as well. And I'd always lean on setting up one through a professional trust organization. So what I'm looking at, you could go to the big service providers such as Momentum and Liberty Life and Old Mutual, etc. They have departments that set up trusts, fiduciary departments. But you'd need some advice along the way too. So I think you'd need to start off plugging in with a good financial planner who would then look at the reason why you should have a trust first and foremost, and then take some advice around that in the context of whether I should step up and create a trust, or maybe I don't need one. Maybe there's an alternative solution which would be far more beneficial for me into the future, taking costs and administrative things into account as well.
Paul, thank you so much for your time. It's a really, really interesting issue, at least we had the time to talk about the intricacies and some of the complexities there. All the best to you, mate.
You too. Great chatting to you again.
Lekkerman. There was Paul Roelofse.